It's Friday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, Britain wastes no time bombing suspected Islamic State targets in Syria.
China, for the first time, has admitted that it was involved, or that Chinese hackers were involved in the attack on the Office of Personnel Management in the United States.
The United States and China discuss cybersecurity. Also ahead, North Korea seeks equal recognition with the South when it comes to kimchi. And may the force or money be with you if you happen to own certain vintage Star Wars memorabilia. It's all on today's International Edition. British lawmakers were locked in 10 hours of intense debate when we last met yesterday, and it was all about a request from Prime Minister David Cameron to take part in airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria. They did approve that request by a vote of 397 to 223, and it didn't take long for action after that vote, as we hear from Henry Ridgewell in London.
Just hours after military action was approved, four British Tornado jets took off from their base in Cyprus to attack Islamic State targets in Syria. The first bombs were dropped on the Omar oil refineries in the east that it's believed were used to fund the terror group. Throughout Wednesday, British lawmakers had held an impassioned 10-hour debate on extending the airstrikes into Syria. Prime Minister David Cameron sought to justify the action in the wake of the terror attacks in Paris.
We should answer the call from our allies. The action we propose is legal, it is necessary, and it is the right thing to do to keep our country safe.
Leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, appealed for more time to seek a peaceful end to Syria's civil war.
Do we send in bombers, not totally aware of what all the consequences are going to be, or do we pause, not send them in, and instead put all of our efforts into bringing about a peaceful, humanitarian and just political settlement?
But Labour's shadow Foreign Secretary Hilary Benn drew applause with his speech contradicting his own party leader and spoke in favour of military action.
Now, I share the concerns that have been expressed this evening about potential civilian casualties. However, unlike Daesh, none of us today act with the intent to harm civilians.
Yeah.
Rather, we act to protect civilians from Daesh, who target innocent people.
Lawmakers voted 397 to 223 in favour of military action. The issue has divided both Parliament and the British public, says Ranj Alaldin of the London School of Economics.
There's two sides to the current debate. One is that inaction has had its consequences, and therefore doing nothing may no longer simply be acceptable or feasible. The other issue is whether military action will make a difference. And I think that's where it gets contentious.
No more war!
Demonstrators opposed to the airstrikes held protests in several cities. Britain has sent eight further jets to its base in Cyprus as the bombing campaign intensifies. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Defense Ministry later said via Twitter that the bombs targeted the Islamic State-controlled Omar oil fields, but it did not provide any assessment of the strike's results. Well, speaking of Twitter, it's time for us to now check out trending stories online. And for that, we turn to our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. She's right here with some colorful news today. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. That's right. Pantone just released a color of the year for 2016. And for the first time in 15 years, the company released two shades for its color of the year, so I guess technically they are colors of the year. They're called Rose Quartz and Serenity. So, Jim, obviously, I'm sure you have the exact shades in your mind right now, right? I mean, who doesn't know what Serenity looks like?
Right. Well, actually, for Rose Quartz, I'm sure that's some type of pinkish color.
Exactly. Rose Quartz is pastel pink, and Serenity is baby blue. The company said the two colors were chosen to convey rosy warmth and tranquility.
Well, that's some interesting news, but how is it relevant to someone who's not into fashion or just colors in general?
Well, the color of the year is applicable beyond shopping for next year's coat. Many industries need to know that when it comes to launching a new product, because depending on the it color of the year, the companies could adjust the color selection of the items they manufacture and sell. So it could really impact everything from paint, bedding, and upholstery.
Well, how does Pantone choose the color of the year?
It begins with a nonprofit based in Alexandria, Virginia. The nonprofit CMG helps pick and predict colors for a number of products, and their members include Pantone employees. The CMG members gather throughout the year in a series of what's called chromosome workshops throughout the world. Jim, I was pretty surprised to learn that virtually everything can influence the selection of colors. We're talking pop culture, sports, technology, and even social issues. And before I go, I want to add that Marsala was a color for this year, reddish brown shade. That's all for me today.
Well, I'm sure the makers of baby clothes are embracing next year's colors.
Mm-hmm.
Your reports are always golden for us. Thank you so much, G. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA _IE and from her own account at G Abby Lee. You can find me out there on Twitter. I'm at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. The United States and China held high-ranking talks this week aimed at furthering cooperation in combating cybercrime. The U.S. Justice Department issued a statement on Wednesday on the results of the first-ever U.S.-China high-level joint dialogue on cybercrimes and related issues. The two sides reached agreement on guidelines for requesting assistance on cybercrime or other malicious cyber activities, and they also agreed to enhance cooperation in combating such cybercrimes as child exploitation, theft of trade secrets, fraud and misuse of technology, and communications for terrorist activities. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide describes details of the talks with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
We've had statements that have come out at the end of the talks that give us kind of a broad overview of the areas where they're going to try to forge forward and cooperate more, particularly in the area of combating cybercrime. They agreed to hold what's called a tabletop exercise in the spring of next year. And basically that's an exercise that goes through cyber scenarios where you look at how both sides would respond. They made some progress on the establishment of a hotline mechanism, but it's unclear to me, at least, what this actually means, whether they're still not to that where they have the hotline set up. Also, they agreed that they would hold talks, another round of these talks in June of next year in Beijing. But that's what was mentioned in some of the highlights. Basic highlights of what was mentioned in the statement. One of the most interesting things I think that has come up is that Xinhua has kind of inadvertently mentioned that that China, for the first time, has admitted that it was involved or that Chinese hackers were involved in the attack on the Office of Personnel Management in the United States.
Yes, that has been so controversial here in the U.S. And there have been talks between U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping, I believe, when the Chinese leader visited the U.S. in September about this. I mean, the fact that the Chinese admit to this, how do we go from here as far as the future and to try to prevent future cyber attacks?
Well, I think for starters, what they've done is they've admitted that criminal hackers were involved, and they've said that the state actors weren't involved. So they've kind of tried to distance themselves. I think this possibly creates a little bit of breathing room for the both sides. But one of the key things that was done during these talks this week was individual cases of cyber attacks were discussed. The statements on both sides don't give any details on, you know, which cases were discussed. But I think, you know, the admitting of this will help them to an extent to try to make some progress forward. And it does seem, at least from the statements, that they are making some serious headway towards finding ways to cooperate and better understand one another in an area that has been highly contentious and a serious point of friction between the two countries.
And it also should be noted that the talks were co-chaired by the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch and Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, along with the Chinese State Counselor Guo Shangkun. I mean, it's very high-level personnel were involved in this.
Yes, very high level. And the fact that, you know, this follows up the state visit by Xi Jinping earlier this year in September, it shows that you know the Chinese government is very serious about this. And you know, in our work on this story, you know, one analyst that we spoke with, you know, was pointing out how what we're seeing happening now highlights how the Chinese government is really trying to, or at least more aware of the sensitivities of the U.S. government and how serious and how big of an issue, you know, this is for the U.S. government. And at least it appears that both sides in China, for its part, is making more of an effort. Now, when it comes to the case of the criminal hackers who are involved, according to China, we also know from the Washington Post that sources involved, you know, with the meetings had told the Washington Post that these hackers actually have already been arrested. But typical to these kinds of things in China, we do not know very little about those who are involved. And because of that, then we do not know whether they have any connections to the government as well. So there's still a lot of questions, but it does appear that, you know, this is being there's a lot of focus on this at the highest levels of government in both countries.
The United States has blamed China for a series of high-profile cyber attacks on U.S. government and business entities in recent years, including the theft of personal information of more than 21 million federal employees after hackers broke into the computer systems of the Office of Personnel Management earlier this year. Traditional North Korean kimchi. It's a spicy pickled vegetable dish, and it's set to gain a prestigious recognition from the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. We know that as UNESCO. It's happening in Namibia, and we hear more from Slotika Hoke.
Kimchi is a spicy and sour side dish made by fermenting vegetables, usually cabbage, with spices such as chili peppers, garlic, and ginger. While it is common in South and North Korea, variations of kimchi are gaining popularity around the world. South Korea has already received UNESCO recognition, and now the North wants it too.
Kimchi is a vegetable dish made by seasoning various vegetables or wild edible greens with spices, fruit, meat, fish, or fermented seafood before they undergo lactic fermentation. Kimchi has hundreds of variations, and it is not only a daily dish, but it is also served on special occasions, such as holidays, birthday parties, weddings, and even at state banquets. The differences in local conditions and household preferences and customs result in variations in recipes and ingredients.
Kimjang, the process by which most South Korean kimchi is made, was granted UNESCO status in 2013. But North Korea claims its kimchi is different and deserves special recognition. North Korean kimchi is less spicy and less red because it uses fewer hot peppers. The communist nation hopes the UN agency will grant its variation of kimchi the status of intangible cultural heritage of humanity.
There are lots of kinds of kimchi. This time I made kimchi with squid. You can use all kinds of seafood to add to the pickling of kimchi.
Regardless of its status, few Koreans can imagine a meal without their traditional pickles. Some even believe it has medicinal properties.
Kimchi is our national food. It's something special, and it's something we just have to have as part of our diet.
Kimchi recipes and ingredients vary from village to village, and not only between north and south. One thing they all have in common is the pungent smell that comes from fermenting, something non-Koreans need time to get used to. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Well, while we don't have the technology to teleport you an actual sample, at least not yet, you can see Zlatica's kimchi report on our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The next installment of the Star Wars movie series, Star Wars The Force Awakens, opens in theaters this month. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, an auction will give fans the chance to own a piece of movie history.
There has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
It has been nearly 40 years since Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Princess Leia, and Darth Vader came to our world from a galaxy far, far away. Now Sotheby's is holding its first ever auction of Star Wars memorabilia, including props, action figures, and other items associated with the films. Hundreds of rare and original collectibles associated with Star Wars will go on the block December 11th in New York. James Gallo is the owner of Toy and Comic Heaven. He says that fans have the chance to own some of the original action figures from 1977 to 1985.
There's over 400 carded action figures from that time frame, which is both a great assortment of stuff and a very high number of figures.
Among the figures are some original Luke Skywalker figures with a two-piece lightsaber in its original packaging. The figure is expected to fetch between $12,000 and $18,000 at auction. James Gallo says that having the extremely rare figure is something special.
I mean, there's probably a dozen or so really rare and significant items in the sale. There's a double telescoping Luke Skywalker on the card, which it originally the lightsaber figures, the Luke, the Ben Kenobi, and Darth Vader had a two-piece lightsaber. It was very quickly changed out to a one-piece lightsaber. So it's a very rare item to have that. There's approximately about 20, 25 known examples of that on the card.
Also up for sale are masks, including an Imperial Stormtrooper and Darth Vader, made from the molds for Star Wars Revenge of the Sith. An autographed lightsaber carried by actor Samuel L. Jackson in the Star Wars prequel trilogy is also available. James Gallo says the sale, which is from the collection of Japanese designer Nigo, even offers something that fans got when there was no Star Wars memorabilia, a promissory certificate from the toy companies.
We have the very first Star Wars action figure item that was produced, which is the store display for the Early Bird certificate package. This item was produced for Christmas of 1977, so the movie came out in May 1977. Nobody expected it to be a hit, so there was no way to get any toy product to market for Christmas time. So Kenner came up with the idea of basically selling an empty envelope, and it's basically a cardboard backdrop with a mail-in certificate, that when you mailed it in, they said, hey, in 4 months, you'll get, you know, a set of four figures in the mail.
Other items up for sale include a set of seven action figures from The Empire Strikes Back that were only sold at Sears stores in Canada. Two framed sets of 62 aluminum coins offered with the figures are available for bid as well. The online auction is December 11th at Sotheby's.com/Star Wars Auction and eBay.com/Sotheby's. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I love it. In 1977, they didn't expect it to be a hit. And yet now, I know for many of you, you cannot imagine a world without Star Wars. Well, you know what? International Edition's been around quite a while, too. That's what you've been listening to, and we'll be back again. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, our handle, @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. The Force is definitely with them. And it makes my day good, too. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. I'm glad you've been with us. Come back again.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Iran, Baha'is, who make up one of the country's largest non-Muslim religious communities, have been a target of persecution by the government for decades, and the persecution continues. Baha'i persons and property are routinely attacked with impunity. Baha'is are denied access to higher education unless they renounce their faith. They are barred from employment in the public sector. They may not inherit property, and they are disproportionately subject to arbitrary arrest. Over 70 Baha'is currently languish in prison because of their religious beliefs. In 2010, the seven leaders of the community were convicted of spurious security-related crimes and sentenced to 20 years, the longest prison sentence given to any prisoner of conscience in Iran. According to recent reports, on November 15th, at least 15 Baha'is were arrested in Tehran, Esfahan, and Mashhad. Reportedly, their families were not informed about their whereabouts or the charges they face. Recent reports also included scores of businesses belonging to Baha'is being shut down in several cities in the Manzandaran province, and authorities closing all Baha'i businesses in the city of Rafsanjan. In its most recent report on the state of religious freedom in Iran, the U.S. State Department noted that the Iranian government discriminates against and creates a threatening atmosphere for all non-Shia, most notably the Baha'is. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran, Ahmed Shahid, has detailed the abuses suffered by the Baha'i community and urged the Iranian government to end its practice of religious intolerance. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, the freedom to profess and practice one's faith is a birthright of every human being.
Religious minorities, including those who profess no faith, should have the same rights as religious majorities. And that is a fundamental belief.
No nation can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs, said Secretary Kerry. We all have a responsibility to affirm our faith in the principles of religious freedom that the world community has endorsed so many times.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.